Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time is here. That's right, we're talking about 1981's Hell Night on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Garth Manor. This is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. And today we're going to unpack all the gory details of 1981's Monster Mash Slasher. Monster Slasher? Sure. Hell Night, in the hopes that a frat... inductees untimely end is just the beginning, the jokes we might make at their expense. And of course, there is only one person I trust that if I give them a gun, that she will make sure it's not filled with blanks before she tries to shoot her way out of a gate. The one, the only, Gina Radcliffe. How are you doing today, Gina?
I have my whiskey and my Quaaludes. I am ready to partay.
Holy shit. Now, Gina, right up front. Right up front here, we have often talked about various movies in this show's history of being executive produced by cocaine, but I think this is the first movie I can think of that it was executive produced by Quaaludes. It is a very Quaalude feeling movie.
Yeah, and yet I feel like that if I was at this party and I indulged in someone's offer of whiskey and Quaaludes, uh-huh, I would just be passed out on a bathroom floor and miss the whole thing.
Yeah. Especially when you're combining it with whiskey. So you got two downs. Like, I would be Snoresville. Any one of these killers would have just taken me out very quickly because I would have no defense. I would be sweepy time.
And you would not know what hit you. So no harm done.
Maybe that's what I'll choose for my death venture, but I don't think anyone really gets it that way. But we'll find out as we go along. Now, I don't want to alarm you, Gina, but we are not alone. That's right. We have a special guest. Now, you know him as a writer, a podcaster, a Lothario to some, and now an author of a book called A Cut Below, a celebration of B-horror movies. The head boy himself, the one, the only, Scott Drebbit. How are you doing today, Scott?
Oh, callbacks, head boy. Wow. Well, thank you.
Callbacks to shows you're not even on right now.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for having me. This is the big time, Kill by Kill. I'm telling you, this is great. You know, one should add, I think the opening party scene, since we're talking Quaaludes and whiskey, I'm pretty sure I saw Bill Cosby floating around in that opening scene in the background.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's not good. Someone should send campus security over there immediately.
Yeah. It's a very 1981 movie. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think thank goodness it was a girl that you know, brings this up, because if it was a guy, it's like, yeah, he is planning to be up to no good tonight.
Yeah, and she was relieved of several things that would have helped in this situation. Cocaine, for one, pot, the other. These are things you can burn and things that could keep you awake in stressful situations. She doesn't have either of those things. She's just got whiskey and Quaaludes and a questionable grasp on dudes' names. Now, Scott,
yes,
what was your first introduction to 1981's Hell Night?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, when this movie first came out at that time in 81, there was always a quick turnaround in from video or from theatrical to video. So I saw it late. 81 on video after its mm-hmm. theatrical run. And when I was 11, let's just throw the cards out on the table here.
Sure.
And I found it to be just a very effective, I'm not going to use the word clever, but an effective, well-shot little, as you said, monster slasher. So,
yeah, it's a weird hybrid that I think is quite interesting. For me, I was aware of the poster art for this well before I ever saw the movie. It is quite evocative. It is Linda Blair trying to crawl up a very tall gate with these giant spikes at the top of them. And to me, as someone who does not enjoy heights, this is a lot of my nightmares wrapped up into one thing, in that I'm high off the ground. I could stab myself on a gate and I'm dressed like Linda Blair in this movie.
So you have your ripe cleavage on display. This is part of your, this is part of your nightmare.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I think it's okay for me to say she has some very impressive cleavage in this movie.
I think everyone in this movie looks good. The problem with this movie, there are a couple, but there aren't many. The problem with this movie is not these, they pick some uggos. There's very attractive people throughout this motion picture. And it's not that they aren't given character beats or moments or time to tell you who they are as human beings. We get that in spades because this takes place over just the course of one night from midnight to 6 a.m. So you're really in the moment with these people. And I think the main problem for me for this motion picture is, like the Quaaludes, you're stuck with people as they walk places or climb a rope ladder. If I see someone touch a fucking rope ladder again, I'm going to lose my mind, Gina.
Yeah, this is a very conversational slasher movie, which is not something you would often see until maybe around like the Scream era. These characters spend an inordinately large amount of time just talking to each other, which is fascinating.
And it's not that is the talking is not the part that I mind. It is walking with them down a hallway, seeing them take every stair down into the basement, watching someone go walk across a roof for a minute and 20 seconds.
Yeah, I clocked some stuff in this too. And it's, you know, it doesn't all have to be real time.
It really doesn't.
You can move ahead an hour. You can move ahead, for God's sakes, 12 seconds and just trim a little.
Yes, you could trim 15 minutes out of this thing and not touch a moment of character work. All you have to do is actually have people reach their destination in, I don't know, a minute rather than 2.5. That would be nice. There's a sequence in which Peter Barton. He goes down to check on a light in the garden. And I swear to God, this sequence takes 10 fucking minutes.
Yeah, there's a couple of those.
And if this was 85 minutes, I think this would have all the cult appeal of any other slasher of the era. In fact, it would probably be better than a good half of those movies.
Yeah.
This isn't a situation, for me at least, Gina, in which we got it ain't good, it might be great. Mm-hmm. I think this is a solid motion picture that, for whatever reason, they took their foot off the gas when it came to the edit.
I think that they were trying to do a little something different with slasher movies.
Yes.
You know, I pointed out to you that, you know, as opposed to a lot of other movies of the same genre from the period, I didn't actually hate these characters. Like, right. there are a couple that are annoying, but I found in particular Linda Blair and Peter Barton's characters, you know, very likable people. You know, even though, like, I, you know, the party girl, what's her name?
Denise.
Yeah. You know, in any other movie, she would be coded as, you know, well, she's kind of slutty, so she deserves whatever happens to her. And here, you don't really get that sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she is like, you know, on the fast track, just, you're dying of an overdose in some, B-level musician's dressing room, but that's neither here nor there.
No, she's the most interesting character.
Right. And I guess you could call him antagonist,
Peter.
The frat people playing the tricks on them. Even they're not terrible. I mean, yeah, the one guy calls the girl a twat, which is gross, but they're not awful. They're not they're not like absurdly terrible people.
Scott's pretty terrible.
Scott should be brought up on charges at some point. Like, he is basically saved, or maybe part of the world is saved when his neck is snapped.
Yeah, Scott is rightfully the first one killed.
Yes. Well, no. I think Suki is actually the first one killed.
Oh, right. You're right. Yeah.
It's not. I'm really going off. Jenny Newman plays Mae West, and Mae is the first person killed. Suki Goodwin plays Denise Dunsmore. She does not die until well into the motion picture.
True.
The only real problem I have with these characters from a character standpoint is too many of them have the same hair. You need to diversify hairs, or someone needs to be in a wig or a haircut or a hat. That really helps with Vincent Van Patten, because he's in a Robin Hood hat for a good portion of that, and you always know who he is.
Yeah, at some point he loses his little drawn on mustache.
he takes them off in a grand gesture and slaps them upon the ground.
He brings such a 70s, early 80s energy to the proceedings, but he's so natural. Like, I don't think this is by any stretch Linda Blair's finest moment on screen, and especially next to Vincent Van Patten, who's just like so full of energy and life, you know. And he's such a good match with Suki Goodwin, which should have been her name in the movie, because I just call her Suki through the whole thing. Right? They're the more interesting couple and the more fun couple of the two, I think, anyway.
Well, I think they're both given time to actually find a dynamic. This is not something you would find in most horror movies going forward from here. This is really attempting to make you like these people, so that because there's so few, you know, in comparison to the Friday the 13th that we covered for so long, Gina, we see these people for much longer than before they pass away. Yeah. They're allowed to make character decision after character decision. And the problem really isn't the script, which I think takes some fun twists and turns here. And in its attempt to do something new, it's really pacing for me.
Right.
So just some background for everyone. This was filmed over basically the Christmas holiday, the 2 weeks between the middle of December and after New Year's Eve. And they had to do it at this point because all these places are kind of occupied by real people. Mm-hmm. So they got them for a steal if they could get the movie done in a certain amount of time, which means they were filming all night. As soon as the sun set, they started filming until the sun peaked up again. And you can kind of tell there's a lot of decisions that are being made by people not getting enough sleep. This was filmed primarily out in Redlands, California. The opening shots are the University of Redlands, which is a private college. It's not part of the UC system. And the place is fucking gorgeous. I went to an art walk there about a decade ago, and it is a really nice spot in the middle of the Inland Empire where the dirtbag elite meet to party and skeet. And you really get a vision of that dirtbag elite during this opening party sequence, which, weirdly, I kept comparing it to other films that we've now covered over the history of the show, Gina. And this opening feels very Terror Train.
Yeah, I could see that.
It's just weird that, like, all this is kind of happening concurrently to one another. It's not like they're all, you know, pinging off of one another in terms of their inspirations. They're all kind of happening at the same time. And, you know, I think there's some fun innovations, and I very much enjoyed the third act chase sequence in the original Terror Train. Mm-hmm. But here, I think what they're going for is that, like, you got to know these people before they're dispatched one by one. And that's effective, more effective than here's a bunch of a-holes. Let's watch, you know, holes be punched in their chest.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying, is that they, you know, they kind of zagged on the audience a little bit by, you know, taking the time to get to know the characters. So maybe you might feel something when they're killed off.
amongst the boredom of watching them walk places. But that being said, like, they have conversations. They have an internal drive. They have backgrounds which come to play during the course of the movie. It's almost as if someone put thought into this, which is weird because it was like written in like a month and a half. They just fired it off. And then they filmed it in even less time than that. And if someone in the edit booth had just like said, maybe we don't need to see this person walk down all the steps of the stairs. Like, I can believe someone can start and stop at the beginning and end. Like, I will understand that they have walked down the stairs. I don't need to see it. It's like on Mystery Science Theater 3000 when they would complain about seeing every car park in a movie. You're kind of seeing that here.
Oh, well, I think it's somebody's, you know, a charitable view of it is it's somebody's attempt to create suspense.
Right.
And maybe not quite there.
Now, I watched this on a Blu-ray that Shout Factory put together, and the movie looks rather gorgeous on that. But at a certain point, I had to step away, and I had to watch the rest of it on my laptop, and I watched it on Peacock. And in both places, the music sounds like somewhat like the Casio is plugged into the same outlet as a microwave. And when everyone is trying to make popcorn, it just goes like, why is this happening? Was this wow. a choice?
I have no idea. Your Blu-ray is possessed by Garths. I don't know.
Yeah.
One could say your Blu-ray player is gorking out.
I've not heard this term before. This was new to me.
Sure.
Where did gork come from? Because I was unfamiliar with this term, even though I am of an age where I probably would have heard that.
You know, I think I had heard it once or twice, but it certainly wasn't one that, you know, caught on with the mainstream, I don't believe. I had heard it once, certainly not the first time I'd seen it. I hadn't heard gork before, but it's so laden with meaning just in and of itself that you know what they're talking about when they say it, although they do lovingly throw around mongoloid a few times as
yeah
well.
That's a tough one.
I
my favorite Devo song, but it's hard to sing along with. And the opening of the sequence of the movie rather is this elaborate party and everyone's in costume, which brings to mind another thing that I really enjoy about this film, because what it comes down to is we're in a haunted mansion movie and there's so many candles. Gina, who lit these candles?
That's what I was wondering. When they go into the room and it looks like, I'm sure I made this comparison before, it looks like that one police video where it's just Sting just dancing, just flailing in slow motion in a big room full of candles. Light those all with individual matches, or did you have one of those oven lighters?
Because when they first come in, when the frat president, walks them through the front door, there are candles already lit. That would be my first question. Who the fuck is lighting all these goddamn candles? You had to shoot open a lock to get in here.
Like candles in these Liberace-sized candelabras.
And while it is, again, we do not come to Hell Night for realism. That being said, the nice part about this is because everyone is in these weird olden time costumes, then when they start walking around a house with a candelabra in their hand, it doesn't feel weird because they're dressed out of time. And now they're in a set that's out of time and nothing quite looks right. It's nothing about this feels modern. And I think for a slasher monster masher, this helps it really feel different than the other, people.
Yeah, because it has no allusions to a modern slasher at all, right? Like you said, it has it has the gothic house, it has the heaving bodice,
right?
you know, it has that atmosphere before it turns into, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, before there was Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 with the underground caverns, which I think is a big selling point of this movie. You guys were talking about the pacing of the film and that, and it's backloaded, like the back half of the movie, the last 50 minutes of the movie are like nonstop with the screws tightening, the suspense ratcheted up, very effective. It's just, you know, it was a different time, right? And
yeah,
sometimes you gotta wait it out, partner.
True.
And there's good stuff there.
Yes. I think there's a lot of good stuff there. And where it wastes a bunch of time is in building. I think the attempt is to build suspense, and what you get is watching someone walk across a roof, and you would just, if you cut out like a good half of that, this movie is like 85 minutes to 90 and it cooks from the word go. I just think that is really the place where it would let down an audience. If it actually built on that sort of dread, if it had dread to give you, then I could deal with the slow burn. But I don't feel the burn here. It's just the slow. And then cool stuff happens. You're like, I want more of that. And yeah, the last half hour in particular is pretty fucking awesome. It's just like, you could have gotten there faster. And boy, I'm telling you, I think this would have blown the roof off of places.
Yeah, you know, I think a similar example to this same year is Jeff Lieberman's Just Before Dawn, which is even a similar kind of premise, just, you know, a change of location, as it were. Yeah.
Well, it uses the same, spoiler alert, everyone, them's two gorks. We got a two gork situation.
Yeah, we were kind of big on the gorks for a little while in the 80s. It was a dark time.
100%. And you know, Gina, you brought it up, and I think we should probably just talk about it a little bit, because now we've kind of covered a few of these movies, and I think we need to have the conversation: who put the peanut in the dirty peanut character? Now, Scott, for your edification here.
Please.
We have referred to characters like this who are kind of cellar dwellers as your dirty peanuts. We kind of came up with this from watching The Unseen.
I was thinking of The Unseen as well.
Yeah, because it actually came from Patrick could not remember the character Pigpen.
Yes.
So he referred to him as Dirty Peanut. Dirty Peanut. And so it has stuck for like every kind of disgusting cellar dweller, not necessarily like mutant or
absolutely,
but like that kind of archetype that was very big in 80s slasher movies.
That kind of musty malevolence, right?
Right. Right. Like I would say the killer from I for some reason watched it. I kept thinking of Madman.
Madman Mars. I wrote that down as one of the other DPs we got here.
Because he's sort of like a gross Santa with hobbit feet. But yeah, so that was just like a weird thing for a while. And it's like, you know, there was a time when it was okay to say this disabled inbred person is probably gonna like, another big one, Patrick. Mm-hmm. The Funhouse.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. The Funhouse is full of dirty peanuts.
Oh, yes. And you got dirty peanuts of every variety in the Funhouse.
You've got like a dirty peanut who kind of looks like a normal person. Mm-hmm. But then you've got like an actual like mutant dirty peanut.
Yes. And then you've got Madman Mars. You've got the killer in the house on Sorority Row, who's a surprise dirty peanut. Like, you don't even know he's a part of that movie. And then all of a sudden, surprise, dirty peanut. You got Belial from Basket Case. He's a mobile dirty peanut. He's been He's been taken out of his normal environment and taken to New York City to become a dirty peanut in the filthiest place you've ever seen in your life.
He just say dirtier peanut.
Right. And then Scott, as a Canadian, I'm sure this strikes home for you. Mm. And that's Ida's son from 1982's Humongous.
Oh, God, Humongous. Yeah, the movie I've watched but never seen.
Right. It's a movie too dark to actually see with your eyes.
That's the Paul Lynch trademark. Also, Prom Night. See Prom Night if you can.
Hey, at least Prom Night has plenty of boogie veins with dictionaries filled with joints. You're not getting any of that in Humongous. Really? I was so excited to finally watch Humongous because that poster art, I'm like, what is that?
Yeah.
I want to see that.
Sure.
And then I got the movie. I'm like, I still can't see it.
I still want to see it. Someday.
And then like The Goonies has a family friendly dirty peanut in it who turns out to be a good guy.
That's right.
You kind of have a variation of it with the evil dead with the sudden oatmeal syndrome, you know, deadites in the basement there. And of course the latest and greatest dirty peanut mother from Barbarian.
Yeah. You killed my argument that, I think the dirty peanut was killed thanks largely to the X-Files episode Home.
Right.
Because, I think horror filmmakers looked at it and said, we cannot make a dirty peanut more terrifying than the characters in this Fox TV sci-fi channel, sci-fi series.
Sometimes you got to let that dirty peanut fall underneath the couch and let it, gather some moss.
But you're right. Mother absolutely qualifies as the rare female dirty peanut.
And so my question to you both, as people who are steeped in horror knowledge, what is the source code for dirty peanuts? Because obviously it's a thing in the air. Like just before Don has, backwoods mutant killers, I think of the vein of a baghead Jason, they're outdoor dirty peanuts. But where's the indoor dirty peanut come from?
Well, that's just your whole, it's Jaws, but on a trampoline park, it's the same kind of thing where you're just moving around the object, right? Mm-hmm. That's all it is. I mean, and you're absolutely right. We're talking, 81, 82 was this prolification of your dirty peanuts. Thank you so much for this phrase. may I use it freely? I will give full accreditation, of course.
We're trying to make it happen.
All right.
We're trying to make fetch happen every day.
I think dirty peanuts should definitely happen.
Yeah.
It was 81. It was 81, 82. We had this big prolification, but it was really, I think, when the prophets of Friday the 13th with that end image of Jason popping out of the water. And then because a lot of them came out like right around the same time in 81, including Baghead and everyone else. So, what's it building off of? It's got to be that. It's got to be the masked killer mixed in with someone decided, let's also mix in, your backwoods, your Texas Chainsaw. And then your permeations come out from there, right? Just before Dawn has some of that. Hell Knight has some of that,
Mm-hmm. Part of it is also specifically like two movies from 1970. Well, three. You've already mentioned Texas Chainsaw. Another movie from then that I think has its DNA here is Black Christmas. Now, Billy's a mobile dirty peanut. He doesn't live in that house and then they arrive. He actually installs himself as the dirty peanut of that sorority house. And then the other one is the TV movie Bad Ronald.
Okay.
Where a guy commits a murder and his mom goes, don't worry, I'll hide you, and hides him in the house. And then Bad Ronald is like a direct line to Barbarian.
Yeah, no, that's, I would say, I also throw in another 70s movie that kind of has certain elements that would be carried over, and that would be Deliverance.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Because you've got these sort of heavily implied inbred people, you know, and you know, they're attacking people who are kind of poking around in their, you know, in their on their land and, you know, getting into what they shouldn't be getting into. So I think you can mind that. You can mind Texas Chainsaw, and you sort of lead into this glut of, you know, giant deformed mutant hides in the woods or hides in the house and kills people.
Which are, in a way, because so many of the movies are kind of going off of like, well, I can't do directly Michael Myers, but how do I do it differently? And I don't want it to be a mystery. And you get plenty of that from the prom nights, the terror trains, the happy birthday to me's, our beloved happy birthday to me. Mm-hmm. And so this is like an alternative for you to go to. Now, here's my proposal for the source code of Dirty Peanuts. I hope people were signing up to listen to this extended riff. And that is The Old Dark House, the Universal movie directed by James Whale, in which Saul Phem is that house's dirty peanut. And once he's revealed, he is just chasing people and trying to kill them in the funniest manner possible. And I think it all comes back to Saul. He is source code for dirty peanuts everywhere.
Grandpa peanut.
Great grampy peanut. The greatest generation's dirty peanut.
And you know what? Now that you mention it, Patrick, that's kind of wonderful because one of the Garth brothers even looks like him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Him and the main zombie from Night of the Living Dead who arrives to the graveyard. They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Yes. And the other guy and the other one who winds up in the pond kind of has an Ed Asner feel to him. Big bushy eyebrows.
Right. Yeah. He's a wild man. I'm not even sure which of the Garth family that one is supposed to be. Is that dad? Is that, who is that?
I think it's dad and one of the sons is what I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the characters they don't spend a lot of time on these family of killers, in which they really do very little to even distinguish them from each other.
Well, I think that's part of the gig is that they're trying everything not to distinguish them from one another until it's revealed there's actually two of them.
Yeah, because right. Peter's opening spiel as they're heading into the manor is actually pretty good. He spells it out pretty good. It's kind of up to you to get your pencils out, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because do I really want to? I don't know. Okay, I got it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gorks, you say? Lovely. Okay, let's go. You know, and
fantastic.
And we're off and running. But I think it's a good explanation, although yes, you are left wondering, of course, which one exactly is this, because then they start talking about the great niece of and the granddaughter and the second cousin and the aunt from Tampa Bay. You know, it gets very convoluted, and you are left wondering which ones it is. It's either the dad and one of the twins, or it's just two of the boys.
Right. Yeah. It's not particularly well defined, I think, on purpose, but as such, you're kind of left head scratching with the math. You're like, this math ain't mathing. That being said, that sort of monologue is delivered to us by Peter Bennett. He's the president of Alpha Sigma Rao. And one assumes the head of the frat's date rape committee. He's staring dead.
It's a very important role.
Someone's got to do it.
Prevalent.
And he kind of gives us our introduction to that this is a frat initiation and that he is someone who is very willing to fuck with people. And as such, there's a girl dead ahead of him who's like, hey, let's go screw. And he's like, hold on. There's a cute little button nose across the way. I got to get interested in Linda Blair.
But it's, again, it's, you know, stemming from the time. Animal House was 78. So if you combine
big Animal House energy to it,
you know, it does. And if you combine, you know, college hijinks with horror, well, then you have, you know, a recipe for success, one hopes. So yeah, it's opening. It's very bro. It's uber bro. The first, you know, 15 minutes, basically, until our main quartet are separated from everyone else. But until then, yeah, it's those were the times. I mean,
yeah,
you can't dismiss them. They are what they are, and that's that.
Yeah, the dance sequences to whatever that Blondie But Not that's playing throughout the first 7 or 8 minutes of this movie. The level of white man's overbite that's happening in this dancing is criminal. Like, it's reaching dangerous levels. An orthodontist should absolutely be consulted, because there's a lot of with shoulders happening.
They got the music in them.
Yeah.
white people are embarrassing. You know, my wife is from St. Lucia, and just on behalf of all white people, I'm sorry, honey. We just can't help it.
So much to apologize for.
We got a lot going on. God. I love swimming in these movies when they're good, especially because not only do you just enjoy it on the basic storytelling level, but the aesthetics are just so wonderful, especially if you were around during that time to see some of this shit, this wardrobe murder that you see on display. You know, I can remember when being a kid and having a green polyester suit with a white, a turtleneck shirt underneath.
Oh, that is quite a combination for a family of textures.
Picture. Yeah. It's child abuse is what it is, but that's for me and my therapist to worry about, but it's always great. I just love watching it on screen. It's wonderful.
That is the advantage that everyone being in costume kind of gives this, is while you get certain flavors of that, it's not like a Friday the 13th, which because they, you know, all that Paramount 8 happened between 1980 and 1989, it gives you a little slices of time in every single movie. Yeah. And this is a little bit out of time because of that. But the haircuts. The haircuts are 1980 to the max.
Those don't lie. No.
Yeah. And soon Peter reveals that it's time for this hazing ritual, and they ensconce every woman who's willing to put her butt on the hood of a car to get on there with a moving torch. And let me tell you something about white people as well. When I see a lot of a parade of white people with torches, I am not comfortable.
Yeah, that's a party you don't want to be invited to.
Yeah, that's a no thanks. But they arrive, and before the gates are even opened, there's a cacophony of woo happening. People have opened a can of woo, and they keep opening them, and people are just wooing as if different members of the family are coming into the opening of a Married with Children. It's just woo, 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 woo. Everyone, back off the woo pedal a little bit. Peter gives the four people who are going to be spending the night in this mansion the whole rundown. We've got Marty, played by the cute button nose of Linda Blair, hitting her own "I'm an adult now" stage of her career.
Yeah, and God bless. I think this is the last movie she made for a very long time that saw any theatrical release.
Yeah. Well, you've got Savage Streets.
Yeah, baby.
You've got some interesting ones in the mid-80s.
That's all I got. Savage Streets. Yeah, baby.
that's one for the record books. That's a movie whose third act will give you the belief that it's as good as the third act, but it's really just the third act.
You just got to land. That's all.
Yes. It's a hard road to hoe getting there, but once you get there, it's worth the journey. You've got Jeff, played by Peter. This face was made for mushing Barton. And of course, longtime fans of the show will remember him from Friday the 13th, the final chapter, and his origin story with Get Bunked. So we love Peter Barton for that. Then we got Seth, who is the kind of guy who will harass local Hawaiian natives with a shotgun for a good story. So we've got that. played by Vincent Van Patten in all his surfer dude broness. And then Denise, played by Suki Goodwin, who's the kind of gal who brings Quaaludes and whiskey to her abandoned mansion parties. Just enjoy your coma, lady.
Just brings, like, you know, a Playboy Mansion's worth of drugs to this, you know, 6-hour-long party.
And because we've narrowed down the cast this much, everyone gets a little time to play here. Like, when they get in and Denise starts, you know, taking out bottles and pills and packets and radios from her cleavage, Vincent Van Patten is having the time of his fucking life. And it all just kind of bounces and enjoys the buoyancy of all of their personalities. And that is the part I really, really like about the movie.
Right. Yeah. It's like, oh, these people are kind of fun. I hope nothing bad happens to them.
Right.
Even though I know very well something bad will happen to at least some of them.
Well, it better. at the end of the day, sorry, I still want results, right? And luckily,
yeah,
this one pulls it off. You know, I just wanted to add before I forget, what a good looking movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well shot by Mac Allberg, right? Who worked with some greats, worked with Stuart Gordon. It's got a really good look to it, which is just another plus. The set design is wonderful because that manor is really a choice location that they really get. I'm assuming the underground caverns are like a whole separate, you know.
Yeah, set. That's got to be.
It's got to be.
That doesn't exist. Once they're inside, that's a completely different location from the outside. The outside is in Redlands, and that's a very arts and crafts mansion, and the architect of it created a duplicate, and it's in Hollywood. And it's the magic fucking castle. So they're basically walking up to the magic castle in the middle of nowhere. So the magic castle has vibes to it. And I think they chose some very good locations to bring vibes to the party.
Yeah, all the shrubbery, you know, all that. Although, like you said, he does prance in the shrubbery a little.
It's a little long. Bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so many, the inside, the outside, terrific. And you can see things, which I like in a movie.
That's a real novelty.
Yes. But it's also not so, we haven't reached the point of the 80s where it looks like they're filming right next to Giant Stadium. There's one key light showing blue from a particular direction, and people walk into their light and you can see them, but there's also plenty of blacks too. Like there is mystery beyond where it is. Again, if they just got from point A to point B a little bit faster, I think we would be talking about one of the most beloved cult films of all time. I think it is that close. So what we have is we have the inside group of four, and we have an outside group of agitators whose goal is to scare them. And so we have Peter, who's the main frat president. And then we have his toady, Scott. Mm-hmm. And yes. Peter's, I don't know, how would you describe May?
She's a girl.
She's a girl. She's the one, she gets the shortest shrift.
That's about as much agency as she gets.
Her butt is talked about behind her back. There's a lot there that she's not being given that everyone else kind of has. But this trio, their goal is to fuck with the people inside. So now you have a dynamic setup, right? they're the people inside are going to get scared of fake things, unaware that there's a real thing that they should be scared of that they have zero awareness of. This is a good idea for a movie, everyone.
Yeah,
it is, in a very Vincent Price way.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's just such a classic setup. You have to spend the night in a haunted house. And we're going to...
Right. It's House on Haunted Hill. Yeah, that's a great place to steal from.
Right. And we're going to rattle some bones.
Mm-hmm.
Except, you know, it's going to get gorky around these parts.
It's going to get a little gorky. I do wish this movie had more skeletons pushing people into acid pits. But you can't have it all.
And then the skeleton gets their own credit in the end. I love that so much. I always laugh every time I see that the skeleton as himself.
It is, that movie has a weird Predator style credit sequence in which people get individual cards. And the skeleton's like, hey, how you doing? Here's a problem I have. And this is a realistic thing being driven into an unrealistic movie. But if I'm presented with the opportunity to sleep in sheets that have not been changed for 12 years, them's a hard pass.
Yeah, I'm just gonna curl up on the couch or this floor, maybe this chair over here.
Yeah, I think Peter Barton has a really good idea, which is turn that chair down so that your back is up against the seat, because you just don't know what's been there lately. Like, it really feels like the Gork twins are living on raccoons.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I don't think they're like getting delivery from Domino's or anything.
But here's a question I have. Help me out, the two of you. Let's solve this. And maybe the answer is right in front of me. But is this the first time that Peter and Scott and Mary, because he's a senior, have done this for Hell Night? Taking someone to Garth Manor, because it would seem to me the kind of thing that they would do every year. Do you know what I'm saying? As a regular thing. If that is the case, why haven't the Garths attacked sooner?
This is a very good question. And one I had as they were driving up, tiki torches in hand. Also because there's only four people pledging to both the frat and sorority. It's a
slow year.
It's a very slow year at Redlands University. And so I think it is the first year. All it would take would be one line of dialogue. Like, we've done some crazy stuff, but this is going to top them all. That's all you need. It's just like one line of dialogue. For all I know, it was there, and it was the one thing they cut.
I was gonna say they're fairly elaborate. You know, pranks suggest that they do this every year. That they're prepared.
No one has a Pepper's ghost that they can just pop through a window and haunt somebody and have electromagnetic doors. This feels like you've had a lot of time and resources to make this happen over and over and over again, or it's all been leading to this moment. And Scott had a one-way ticket to be an Imagineer in Anaheim until his untimely end.
Oh, I'm sorry. Those little details are just beautiful. You know, that's good writing. I think that's good writing.
This is one of those things where the moment meets I'll put this in Dick Fingers' men. And that they have always dreamt of doing something this crazy and this elaborate. And for whatever reason, they can only do it to four people in total, which seems like an enormous waste of resources, but whatever.
Well, you can't do five. It just fucks everything up. So
the dynamics are off. It doesn't feel as fun.
Yeah.
But once they're inside, it is basically waiting for them to discover what's really going on. And they know that the screams they hear and, you know, the weird noises, they're pretty convinced are being done by this outside trio. And as such, while scary and annoying, they're not actually dangerous. But what we know is that May, when traversing one side of the building to the other, gets sucked into a zombie pit and she gets her head chopped right the fuck off.
Yeah, that thing just flying. Like,
they have access to some pretty heavy duty cutlery. That is not a knife one has just hanging around the domicile.
Yeah, you've got like one of those. They've got one of those like wheels, right? That you use to sharpen a knife. They're just doing that right all year round when they're waiting for the next, you know, group of frat kids to show up.
And as such, like, there's an element of this that feels very Scooby-Doo, that feels out of time. They're all dressed like weirdo Hammer horror people. And it just makes it feel different in a way that not in Terror Train, they're all dressed in costumes, but you can tell everyone's on a fucking train. Like, there's nothing really old timey about having sex with a guy in a full lizard costume. Whereas here, doing it with a guy dressed up as Robin Hood just feels nicer.
But you know what? Here's the thing too that I found interesting is it's quite chaste, this movie.
Yeah.
There's no nudity that I can remember. I don't believe there is.
When someone flashes, all you see is her back.
Yeah.
There's a lot of décolletage, but yes, but, you know.
Seth and Denise's, you know, dalliance is really actually just kind of funny and cute. And, you know, Peter and Marty just talk it out, man, you know?
Yeah.
So
they reach the makeout stage by exhaustion, yeah, so, and actually charming one another.
So for that time, for a movie, again, I just think it's another thing that helps it stand out is in the midst of every film, you know, showing full nudity, as the precursor to murder, this one, you know, isn't. And there were others of the time, some others of the time too, but more of the norm was, you know, nudity, death. This kind of skips the nudity and almost forgets to skip the death, but then picks it up.
Yeah, it really picks it up in the back half. But I think it's trying to eke things out and have a different pace. Sometimes that pace pays off, sometimes it does not. But I think this isn't a movie that is like so bad it's good. This is a genuinely good movie that just has a little too much air in some of the creeping around sequences. Well,
one could say it's a little Scorsesean in its pacing.
Yes, yes. It's taken its sweet ass time. But when it gets to the destination, it's really trying to deliver. The decapitation, while not hyper gory, you see exactly what's happening there. And when Scott finally reaches the other side of the roof,
yeah,
and gets his head twisted around,
yeah,
that is a super fun magic trick that does not require a bunch of blood and gore to make it seem grisly. It just causes a reaction. It seems a little too real. It's him turning his head around with a false body, and it just fucking works.
Yeah, so that's good editing as an instance. Yes.
And so one by one, the outside trio is being cut off, and the inside trio is being scared by things that are not actually dangerous. Like when Denise gets fooled by this weird two-way mirror gag with Scott, and she's all, oh, the Quaaludes, what are they doing to my skin? And he's so disappointed.
Yeah, I know.
I also think, like, that is a charming moment, which we think, oh, he's going to get it or she's going to get it, and they're going to see it in the mirror, and they tease and they tease and they tease, and it doesn't quite happen. And then after that is when, you know, Peter gets chased through the garden, and part of that garden chase you could lose a little footage.
Yeah, you could shave it down a tiny bit.
A tiny bit. But when he gets a scythe through his chest, you get to see a scythe go through a chest. Like they're trying to deliver on the promise when it is appropriate.
Yeah. You know, this movie, I was in a, it was an avalanche of horror movies were being released on videotape when this one came along, and this one was kind of right in the midst of all of the slasher stuff. And it just stood out for these reasons alone. The quiet moments, the underground caves, the topiary stuff. It was just so different from what I was watching that I would just go back and watch it again and again and again, just because it's fun and it doesn't have anything on its mind other than giving you, as you said, the old dark house.
The one thing that I found quite disturbing about this is that this house, Gina, has working toilets.
Well, I mean, you know, presumably the Gork twins live there.
Would they live in the underground cave? You don't need working toilets when you're subterranean. They are fine. They've got a one designated wall of the cave.
Well, I mean, or maybe like one little, you know, comfort and privacy.
I don't think I don't think they're concerned with comfort so much.
Based on where they dine every night with a corpse chorus, it sounds like they're living like Ega, Gina.
That's true. Yeah. Just toss an Irish soda bread.
So one Gork boy steals Denise and leaves behind May's head where she was resting. This, of course, freaks out Seth, and he lets everyone know, I'm getting the fuck out of here. All I need is one decapitated head. I don't need any more than that.
I mean, and that's time totally reasonable, to get loose. Honestly.
Yes. And we're very early on introduced to the gates of this movie, the gates that are featured prominently in the poster for the film. They're intimidating. They're very tall. And he's like, you know what? I take my shoes off. I got a good chance of getting over this thing. And the one really scary part for me is him hoisting himself over the razor sharp spikes on top of this.
Yeah,
that actually got to me.
Well, for me, this was the funniest part because they throw his boots over top of the gate when there's like 6 inches.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's like underneath. It's like, oh, you could absolutely just put those boots between the bars.
You could just squish them and pop them through. You don't need to toss them like, I hope this works.
Yeah. Just like flang.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
That's the funniest moment in the film, I think.
And so Seth makes his way into town, and here's another wonderful zag that this movie gives us, and one that I feel is very interesting for the times. It's almost as if they took the one sequence in which Laurie is seeking help outside of the house she's babysitting in when she's already been attacked by Michael, and she's like, help me, help me, and they turn off the porch lights on her. This entire town is turning off the porch lights on this dude.
Yeah. Well, because they know what's happening. They know that it's, you know, it's, you know, that this frat thing happening. You know, they probably had to deal with these people's shit many times before.
Right. And in particular, he's like, if I have to deal with one more of you, I'm going to lock you in jail for 30 days. And Seth's like, all right, I can try to really raise the alarm and show them that I'm serious about the murder I've witnessed. Or I can sneak into an exposed gun room and just grab some gun.
Yeah, that's you. Just pick them up a little gun. You know, like someone would take some cheese off a platter.
That police station is in Sierra Madre, which we saw in Halloween 2 a whole bunch. Sierra Madre, beautiful part of town. Couldn't afford to live there, but always loved to see it on film. And so Seth, you know, while he's gone, we have, you know, we've got Jeff and Marty petrified of leaving where they are, but they can't make it over the gate. They're trying to hunker down until they see a light in the middle of the garden. And that's where we get Jeff's interminable 10-minute journey into the garden to pick up a flashlight and discover that Peter is dead. The less said about this, the better.
It was definitely one of those pick your edits spots. Yeah. Oh boy.
If you don't have actual dread, if there's not going to be a chase here, if the reveal is exactly what you think it is, which is Peter's dead, and of course Jeff doesn't know this, but you could have done that in like 2 minutes, 3 minutes tops. What? 10 minutes is inordinate. It's almost as if they weren't going to reach their full funding unless this movie was an hour and 40 minutes.
Well, let's tack on another 10 minutes by, yes, he did tell us Denise was dead, but I'm going to ignore that. Let's go back inside and find her.
Yeah. Yes.
Just, you know what? Wait by the gate. Just hang out by the gate. That's what I would have done. But right. Again, it would have been a much shorter movie instead of the 90-minute movie we wanted.
Well, Jeff may know that the police in town are fucking useless, as the police in almost every town are fucking useless. So he's like, if we're going to do anything, we're probably going to have to do it ourselves. And so when he goes down the trap door after pitchforking the guy, who does not seem to hurt him in any conceivable way, shape, or form, he just sneaks down a trap door. And so he's like, I'm going to go down after her because I would like to think someone would go down after me. And Marty's like, well, I could stay here or fuck it. I'm going with you. You have a pitchfork. And so they go down into the bowels of the mansion. And this is where we get that lovely Texas Chainsaw-esque dining room scene of the rest of the Garth family. Well, I might remind the audience, their deaths took place 12 years before this movie takes place, mm-hmm. meaning essentially 1958 is when this happened. What? They were living in a house with candles?
No, in 1958?
68. Well, yeah, 68. It's even worse.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, you got this whole 10 minutes of walking down there with a pitchfork in front of you. And then finally they discovered Denise's demise. She's been slashed, I guess. You don't get a good look. She's just got a trail of blood down her neck.
Yeah, one of the like kill count sites says that her throat is slashed.
Yeah, sure. I don't doubt it. It that seems to make sense because we're not really shown anything in particular. And so they try to make their way out. And of course, one of the Gork brothers is hot on their tail and they have a pitchfork grab and fight at the top of the stairs. And for whatever reason, Jeff thinks if I push this guy real hard, this is going to do it for me. This guy's going to fall down the stairs, but he pushes so hard that both of them go flying, not even down the stairs. They sail over the stairs until they hit the floor.
That would happen to me.
It's like you hit the XY button at the same time on a video game.
They super jumped,
yeah.
And so as a result, Jeff is hurt. I'm not entirely sure. He never really enunciates exactly where he's hurt. I'm assuming like a broken ankle or something along those lines.
He broke his carefully carved chin line.
I was gonna say he broke his hair.
I don't think either of those things can be damaged. They're too pristine. They're too pretty. They're too perfect. They make their way outside via a hidey hole in the wall that neither of them up until this point know exists, but somehow they're like, yeah, just they push on this false wall like they're fucking Hardy Boys, and they make their way outside, put a pitchfork in it. Meanwhile, Seth shows up with a shotgun, and wouldn't you know it, one of the Gork brothers, we don't know there's two of them at this point, passes by the gate. So he chases after him with the shotgun and manages to shoot this dude in the chest, not once, but twice. And finally, it does the thing not many horror characters do, which is, I'm going to pull you out of this frog pond to make sure you're really dead before I move on.
Sure.
You're like, yay, he's here to rescue everybody. And he shows up at the bottom of the stairs and is like, come on, we're getting out of here. And of course, he gets yanked by the surviving Gork brother. And I'm assuming neck snapped or strangled. We don't know.
Well, I thought he got shot. They were like fighting over the gun. Then you hear like a gunshot. So I assume he gets shot.
Yeah.
That is entirely reasonable since we don't see it. Yeah. It could have been, I kind of assumed that they were fighting with the shotgun and its landing kind of was the shot, but I don't know. Oh. You don't see. It's an illusion.
We got to Zapruder that shit. Let's go.
Let's figure it out.
I remember that really sticking. No, but I remember that really seeing that for the first time, like I said, at the age of 11 or whatever it was. Was very effective as a genuine, you know, suspenseful moment. I remember jumping the hell the first time I saw it and laughing like, okay, you got me, good one, you know? And like you said, so old fashioned. Definitely not an overly gory movie. I don't think it would play as well if it did. I think it would lose a little bit of its charm. For me.
And so they make their way back upstairs because they're not going to pass by that door, and they try to make their way out a window. But the other Gork brother has other ideas, and Jeff says, go run, Marty, run. And she listens and she gets, as far as she can up to the roof. And unfortunately, Jeff does not do as well as he's trying to get out the window. This particular Garth brother picks him up and just heaves him onto the stone steps below.
Yeah, Jeff. I'm kind of sad. Jeff should have been able to be a final boy.
Nah, Jeff, you got gorked.
We got gorked. Actually, we can't honestly say we hardly knew you. We knew you pretty well.
We knew these people reasonably well. Like, as close as it comes to an unknowable person is May, because she's given like six lines before her untimely end. Everyone else kind of tells us who they are and their hopes and dreams. And so their deaths mean something when they actually happen. And then we have a final chase with Marty versus our last Garth. And she makes her way down that interminable fucking rope ladder again. It's been established, everyone. That rope ladder's been there the whole movie. And she gets outside to where the car is. And it won't start. And then, wouldn't you know it, the thing we've been told since minute 15 of this movie, that she was raised, her father was a mechanic, and she grew up working in his garage, pays off when she fucking starts that car by her own smarts.
Brilliant.
I enjoy this. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, she is not she starts it off as a kind of, a little helpless and, I don't know what I do, help me. But, she pulls it together by the end of the movie.
Well, she doesn't know how to do that other shit. She does know how to fix a fucking car in a pinch. That's the thing. Like, she doesn't know how to, work a sword, or she doesn't know how to fix light bulbs or shit. What she does know how to do is fix a car. And when she needs to, she does exactly what she has to. Unfortunately for her, she has a dirty peanut passenger on the top of that car. We get a little Halloween flashback as Garth bust open the window, and we have a car that is steering itself for the most part into this. She's backed into a gate at some point, and now those deadly spikes are sticking outwards. And wouldn't you know it, when she manages to drive that car without her hands on the wheel back to where that gate is, She rams that gork right into it. And it is, and that is an impact that he takes.
Yeah, he's just still hanging on when daylight comes.
Yeah, she gets knocked out. She wakes up and he's still there. And I was waiting for that hand to move. They kind of focus in on her head a little bit while she's walking by him. And I'm like, you know, I've seen this movie before, but I wouldn't be surprised if he reaches out and grabs her for one last scare. But nope, this movie is too restrained. It's too proper for such nonsense.
Too classy. That's what it is. It's too fucking classy.
Very classy
affair. You know what? Another thing that I dig about this movie is that poster that, and also VHS cover art with Pray for mm-hmm. Day and her at the fence, that you actually get that scene in the, which is very rare for poster art, you know, of the day. You didn't always get what was advertised, especially if your poster's from Ghana, right? So.
God, I love those things.
Those are just amazing. So I think that's just kind of neat. It's just one more little thing to put in their goodness bowl, is that you get what's advertised on the cover.
Yeah. This movie was modestly budgeted. It only took about $1.5 million. And it's paying for a lot of locations and good actors. And I think it makes the most of that. Unfortunately, when it landed at the box office, it didn't really multiply. It only made $2.5 million, which is why I think this movie just kind of gains a reputation based on that poster, based on that VHS cover art over the years. And I think it deserves more praise, if I'm being honest.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed this.
It really does zig where others zag, whether it's the two brothers thing, whether the fact that it's not a hardcore slasher movie with a masked killer sort of thing situation. It's giving you what you want in a way you didn't expect. And as such, I find it fucking delightful.
I concur.
I will go along with that as well.
It's official, everyone. And you know what also is official? When we play Choose Your Own Death Venture, and that's where we decide of the deaths in this motion picture, if we were forced to die that way, which one would we choose and why? Up for bid today, we've got just straight up strangled to death, which is how we're going to go through some Garth deaths here. Strangled to death, bashed with a fireplace poker,
yes.
Stabbed with a fireplace poker, hung apparently. And then now we're getting to the on-screen deaths. We've got decapitated in an underground lair, head twisted around 180 degrees, your fake parrot intact, scythe through the chest in the garden maze. We've got neck slashed, and then you're sat at the dinner table, a shotgun to the chest 2 times, and you end up in the pond. And then we got either shot with a shotgun or strangled. We don't know how Seth dies, but it can't be great. Then you got thrown out a second story window or rammed into the spikes on a gate. And here's the deal, Scott,
yeah.
You're our guest. So I choose you to go first.
Oh, bless you. I mean, there's only one choice that I could and should make, and that's, of course, my namesake. It's the best on-screen death, I think. And, so I'm going with Scott's death by head twistification.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. I mean, you're going to have to show up to a party in that pirate costume, however.
Yeah.
You're going to have to wear a patch over your eyeglasses. Are you okay with that?
I'm perfectly fine with that.
Duly noted. Gina, what say you?
You know, I think I'm going to take getting thrown out of a two-story window, because I just like Jeff so much as a character. And you know, I want the audience to love me until the bitter end.
Sure.
And I also really want nice cheekbones and excellently feathered hair.
Oh my God.
Don't we all?
He has the best hair. Yeah, truly. What a way to go, honestly. My only problem with that is the heights. I'm not into heights. That is not particularly a way I want to do it. So I think I'm going to go with dragged down into the basement and have my head chopped off.
Wow.
Only because I look great in leopard print. People don't know this, but it's true.
It sounds more painful, although more fashionable.
Not for long. I mean, by the time you're aware of it, that it's happened. You're gone. You're donezo. You're bye-bye. You're in another place.
Honestly, one of the last things anybody thought of you before you walked away your doom is that you had a nice butt.
Yeah, that's what I want people to say. When I finally go, like, he wasn't as funny as he thought he was, but man, he had a great butt. I think I can live or die with that, honestly. Josh Hollis does all of our artwork and Revenge Body Memphis at bandcamp.com does this theme and all our other remixes. Now, Scott,
yes.
Why don't you tell the good people where they can find you and where they can find your book?
Okay. Me make word on web. Yeah, you can find me. That is Scott Drebbit over on, I'm usually on Blue Sky at Phantasm mm-hmm. 2, which is also my handle over at the strip mall. mm-hmm. Yeah, and the book is A Cut Below, A Celebration of B-Horror Movies, 1950s to 1980s. And if they don't have it at your favorite independent retailer, get them to bring it in. Otherwise, you can go through the usual channels and you can hit up McFarland directly. It's out now. And if you love B-horror, I hope you dig the book.
And it's an excellent format. And I feel like you talk about a lot of movies that do not get a lot of discussion about them. I think you find a way to pair them with one another in a very interesting way. And I find your writing delightful to read.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm trying to have something for the more seasoned horror person and for the person who's delving into the genre for the first time. So I'm trying to strike that balance. And like I said, I just hope people get a kick out of it.
I think they absolutely will. Gina, where can people find you on these here internets?
I write about movies and television at spool.net. I have a Substack, Gina Watches Things.substack.com. I'm on all social medias except for Twitter under Gina Does Things.
Do it today. People, check it out. You can find us on the socials with the exception of Twitter. Fuck that place. We're on your Blue Skies and your Instagrams and your Threads and whatnot. We're enjoying ourselves. Come find us on Patreon. I'll tell you that right now. We got fun stuff for you to listen to. In particular, this month we have a bonus episode by the same director as this movie, Reform School Girls. We're going to talk about that because we saw the poster in The Lost Boys and said, well, fuck, let's watch that movie. So we're talking about it over there. We got commentaries and Q&As for you. Lots of good stuff. And of course, please rate and review us on the podcatcher of your choice, whether it's 5 stars or lovely comment. Share us with people. Let people know that the show is out there because that helps us be seen and heard by more people. And that just about does it, folks. But don't worry, the body count will continue. For myself, for Gina, and Scott, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.